and welcome to the Wednesday preview edition of Radio EcoShock. Tonight I'm going to kick back and let two of our contributors do most of the heavy lifting. We'll start out the program with a hot half-hour interview with activist Derek Jensen. He's the author of books like Endgame, a theory that modern civilization has overstayed its welcome. It's destroying the Earth and should be helped into an early grave. I've done a feature on Jensen earlier, played it here on CFRO Co-op Radio, and over 1,000 people have since downloaded that from our website at ecoshock.org. Now Zoe Blunt, the former host of Green Monkey, our predecessor here at the station, has a fresh interview with Derek that you won't want to miss. In the last half hour of the program, we get a little wetter. I give a brief interview with Dr. Manfred Krauter, a scholar visiting from Germany to study one of the wonders of the sea world, whole towering reefs of sea creatures that science thought were extinct. We have these glass sponges, a throwback from 200 million years ago, right here on the British Columbia coast. International scientists are pushing to protect them as a World Heritage Site, but Canada has been dragging its feet and literally dragging the last of the glass sponge reefs with trawlers. Find out about the treasure you didn't know we had. Finally, we have a speech recorded here in Vancouver by Ann Jameson. Professor Karen Backer tells us that Canadians are floating on a series of dangerous myths when it comes to our water supply. Of course, we are the wealthiest water people in the world, completely protected by our vast geography. That's the myth that lets us waste and pollute one of the last great pools of fresh water in the world. Myths about Canada's water coming up later in the show. In our regular Friday show, starting at 1 p.m., we'll have a report on the latest warnings by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and how global warming will affect Canada's future. In the last half hour, Friday, we'll replay the Derek Jensen interview for those of you who miss it. You can tell your friends, Radio EcoShock Fridays at 1 o'clock on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio. Next week, CFRO begins its Emergency on Planet Earth special programs for fundraising. Actually, it starts Saturday morning with Red Eye, 9 to noon, investigating the links between environmental degradation and social justice. Then Monday night from 7 to 9 p.m., Stark Raven does a double feature on criminalizing the environmental movement, from court injunctions to anti-terrorism laws. Next Tuesday, I'll be hosting the station's first ever Earth Emergency Marathon, 8 hours of non-stop coverage of the dangerous state of the planet, wiping out ocean life, extinctions in the rainforests, and tons about climate change. It's scary stuff, but we do have solutions as well. You'll hear speeches and interviews from people like George Monbiot, Thomas Homer Dixon, and dozens of top scientists. Look out, Jerry Lewis. The 8-hour Earth Emergency Marathon starts at 12 noon and goes to 8 at night, Tuesday, April 17th. Then Radio EcoShock takes to the air next Wednesday night, the 18th, for a 2-hour special called Climate Change, Scams, Solutions, and Survival. I don't want to give it all away, but I think we'll have interviews with Terry Tamminen, Arnold Schwarzenegger's advisor, and from George Monbiot. What you need to know and do to keep the world and life as we know it. Wednesday night, 6 to 8 p.m., the Radio EcoShock special. On Saturday from noon to 1:30, America Latina al Día will be honoring Earth Day with a special on the destruction of the Amazon and other rainforests. Then Sunday, April 22nd, from 5:30 to 7 p.m., Rumba America holds its Earth Day special. Host Sarita Galvez brings you a special with music about our struggle to save the planet. Then the week wraps up with stories from the Earth Sunday night from 9 to 10 p.m. That's a lot of special programming. Stay tuned to CFRO all next week and help us turn the world around. All right, let's meet Derek Jensen.
Welcome to Wild Earth Radio. I'm Zoe Blunt, and today I'm speaking with deep ecology author Derek Jensen about his most recent book, Endgame, The Problem of Civilization. Derek Jensen is visiting Vancouver and the Sunshine Coast April 18th through 21st. He'll be discussing the need for action to stop this culture from destroying the planet.
What do you want?
You've talked about, and I agree with this, a world where every year there is more salmon.
What do salmon need to survive? They need for dams to be removed. They need for industrial logging to stop. They need for industrial fishing to stop. They need for industrial agriculture to stop because of runoff. They need for global warming to stop, which means they need the industrial economy to stop.
Derek Jensen, thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Your book Endgame is has been getting a lot of attention, and you write that civilization and the civilized continue to create a world of wounds. Why is it so difficult for some people to contemplate the end of civilization?
I think that, well, two things. One is, I think one of the reasons is because we identify more closely with being civilized beings than we do with being animals who need habitat. And another way to talk about that is that if your experience is that your food comes from the grocery store and your water comes from the tap, you will defend to the death the system that brings those to you because your life depends on it. If, on the other hand, your food comes from a land base and your water comes from a river, then you will defend to the death the land base and that river because your life depends on that. And right now, that brings me to the third part of this, which is, like any good abusive system, this system is made dependent upon it. And another thing, important thing about the whole question of abuse having to do with this is that one of the things that happens within any abusive dynamic, that's true whether we're talking about an abusive family or an abusive culture, is that everything, and I mean everything, in this dynamic is set up to protect the abuser. And so every member of an abusive family comes to identify more closely with the abuser's feelings than they do their own. If you look at all the solutions, in quotes, proposed for global warming by anywhere, all of them, what do they take as a given? They take as a given industrial capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
That's the baseline. The baseline is not the real world, the real physical world, which must be the baseline for all of our decisions. Because without a world, you don't have anything. I've got a new slogan, which is protect your land base. You can't have sex without it.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the complaints about Endgame, and most of the hate mail, frankly, that I've gotten about Endgame has not come from people who think civilization will go on forever. Most of it's come from pacifists and lifestyle activists. And one of the jokes I've started making is that I should write a version of Endgame called Endgame for Pacifists, which would be 1,000 blank pages and one page in the middle that says sometimes it's okay to fight back.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the only thing that they're hearing in the entire book, or the only thing they're reading in the entire book. All the other analysis goes by the wayside because they see that, it triggers them, and they can't think about anything. And I've gotten a lot of hate mail from both pacifists and also lifestyle activists who get very upset when I suggest that we need to do more than live simply.
Mm-hmm.
That there are power structures. It's like I was a pioneer a few years ago. This was so frustrating because there's all these people talking about all these, you know, wonderful ways that people can have more sustainable agriculture, or more sustainable buildings, or anything else. And I was the only person there that I know of who was talking about either power or psychopathology.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we can all, you know, talk all we want. We can all fantasize all we want about these, you know, groovy eco-socialist utopias, but we know what the dominant culture does to sustainable cultures.
Mm-hmm.
It destroys them and steals their resources, steals their land.
Right. You said you can't make peace with an abuser. You'll lose the peace as surely as you'll lose the arguments. And that's the problem that you have with civilization and that we all have. We can't make peace with this civilization.
I keep thinking about this line by Red Cloud, talking about the whites. He says, they made as many promises more than I can remember, and they only kept but one. They promised they would take our land, and they did it.
Right.
It's relentless. It's utterly relentless.
So why don't more people fight back?
I think the first reason is because most of us are insane.
Mm.
You know, most of us identify, as I said, more closely with the system than we do with our own bodies. I ask people at every talk I do, I say, how many people here have had someone you love die of cancer? And about 70 or 80% of the people will raise their hands everywhere I go. And of course, cancer is a disease of civilization caused in great measure by the toxification of our total environment. And that's how close it gets. You know, this is people's mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, lovers. This is people themselves. I have a disease of civilization, Crohn's disease. It's a horrible disease. And it's a disease of civilization. And you know, how close? That's the question I keep asking. How close does it have to get before we fight back? I mean, every stream in the United States is contaminated with carcinogens. Okay, that's one reason we don't, that more of us don't fight back. Mm-hmm. Another reason is, as I said, we've been made dependent upon the system. We don't know how to live. Another reason is because we're all, so many of us are so afraid of the natural world. I mean, I live 3 to 1 mile from my mom, but I walk back and forth all the time. And there's bears all over the place in this forest, and people say constantly, gosh, aren't you afraid? There's only one person dies in all of North America every 2 years because of a bear attack.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, in the United States, 46,000 people die every year because of automobile crashes.
Mm-hmm.
But we can't see that. We don't see that. Life is not so scary and horrible. I mean, that's one of the things we're terrified of, the natural world.
Yeah.
And that's another reason we don't defend it, is because we think that without this system, we couldn't survive. Well, I'll tell you this. I mean, the Talawa Indians on this land I now live, they lived here for 12,500 years, if you believe the myth of science, without destroying the place and without being killed by all the nasty, mean, horrible grizzly bears.
Right.
And so that's another reason we don't fight back. Another reason we don't fight back is because we've all been taught that civilization is good. We've all been taught that progress is good. And we don't even think about these things. And another reason we don't fight back is because non-humans don't matter. I mean, they're just trees. They're just board feet. They're just dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So what if some little rat disappears? So what if some little, you know, so what if some stupid fish can't adapt to this culture? I mean, it's because we're all really narcissistic. And another reason we don't fight back is because this culture is based on a rigidly defined yet often unarticulated hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And violence done to those higher on the hierarchy to those lower is often invisible. We don't even see it at all. Violence done by those lower on the hierarchy, those higher, is met with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victim. I mean, and this is true, you know, within families, you know, if there's an abusive family, like in my own family, my father, my brother has epilepsy from blows to the head, he broke my sister's arm, he raped my mother, my sister, and me. But the one time my brother fought back, he was beaten far worse than at the time because the violence was going, he was committing blasphemy, violence going in the wrong direction. So we can't even conceive of fighting back. And then there's another thing, too, that's very, very important, which is Zygmunt Bauman, in his great book, Modernity and the Holocaust, talks about how the smartest thing the Nazis did was they made it so that at every step of the way, it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist.
Right.
Would you rather get an ID card, or would you rather resist and possibly get killed? Want to move to a ghetto? Do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Want to get on a cattle car? Do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to take a shower? Do you want to resist and possibly get killed? At every step of the way, it was in their rational best interest to not resist. It's so much easier just put our heads down and go along.
Mm-hmm.
Or no, we put our heads down and go along, but then once in a while, we'll hold up a little sign.
Mm-hmm. And complain.
Or maybe, I just got an email from somebody who participated in an anti-war protest not very long ago, and she said that she was really disgusted because basically it was a big party. Basically everybody was just singing and dancing, and it's a chance to get together and feel good about yourself while accomplishing not very much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've got nothing against, you know, celebrating and feeling good, but the world's been killed, you know? Let's get down to it.
Right. You write a great deal about the violence that civilization has committed on us and on the earth. But yet some of us do fight back.
Yeah.
What makes us different?
I'm not,
what makes
I was
us
waiting
different?
For the question.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's a good question. You know, I guess probably the answer is different for every one of us who fights back. And by us, I also mean, you know, the tigers who fight back and the salmon who fight back and everybody else who fights back too. I'm guessing that the answers are different for each of us on how it is that we woke up, how it is that we, you know, woke up from this nightmare. You know, what it was that made it clear that the system's not redeemable, or even more fundamental, but if we're talking about fighting back, you know, if we're including fighting, if we don't just mean like taking up arms, we also, which, you know, when I talk about fighting back, I don't mean just blowing stuff up or whatever. I'm talking about everything, all forms of resistance, including the stuff we're making fun of the protests.
Mm-hmm.
I include that too. That's part of it. And so is filing lawsuits. And so is, you know, pouring through county zoning regulations to, you know, find a place where the developer's lying. So is lobbying, for that matter. So, you know, I've got a friend who's a great activist, and the thing he's been doing for the last few years is doing those shareholder resolutions which I actually don't think they're very useful, but it's his form of fighting back. And that's a really, you know, that's great. And that's really, that's important too. And so when I say fighting back there, I mean, I guess the question is, you know, how is it that some of us open up and we feel, and we, there we go, there's the answer right there. How is it that some of us open up and end up feeling? How is it that some of us, fall in love with the land where we live? How is it that some of us, what is it that makes some people fall in love with that? It's like, there's this line by this Canadian lumberman, when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And why is it that some people, when they look at trees, they see dollar bills, and other people, when they look at trees, they see trees? And I don't know why some people resist at all, and I don't know why some people then, to take it a step further, I don't know why some people see that the system is irredeemable and resist more. I read something by one of the Black Panthers the other day, saying that when he joined the Black Panthers when he was 17, he knew that he was going to either end up dead or in prison. And what is it that makes a person go there?
You've written about hope in regard to reforming civilization, and you've said hope is harmful.
I don't want to reform civilization, by the way.
No. So you're saying hope is harmful when it comes to our goals.
Okay, let's back up a second.
Sure.
What are our goals?
What are our goals?
Yeah, what are your goals? What do you want?
You've talked about, and I agree with this, a world where every year there is more salmon, where there are more old-growth forests, where there's more spotted owls, for example. We're about to lose the last of our spotted owls here in Canada. If we want to stop that, then what do we have to do?
Okay, that's great. The first thing I think we have to do is figure out what we want.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing we have to do, I think, is figure out what it takes for those creatures to survive. And it's pretty fundamental. I mean, what they need is habitat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, end of conversation.
Right.
I'll talk to you later. You know, it's like, that's really all they need. What do salmon need to survive? They need for dams to be removed. They need for industrial logging to stop. They need for industrial fishing to stop. I'm not saying they need for fishing to stop. They need for industrial fishing to stop. They need for industrial agriculture to stop because of runoff. They need for global warming to stop,
mm-hmm.
which means they need the industrial economy to stop.
Mm-hmm.
They need for the oceans not to be murdered. And each of those is pretty straightforward. I mean, what would we do if there were space aliens who were putting in all these dams and who were vacuuming the oceans? We would know what to do. So that's the first thing. I mean, the problem is so often when people say, what will it take for salmon to survive? What they mean is, what will it take for salmon to survive, given that we're not going to remove dams, we're not going to stop industrial logging, we're not going to stop industrial fishing? It's the same. What do spotted owls need to survive, given that, that we're going to allow all of their habitat to be clear cut? It's like, once again, what is primary and what is secondary? What's always considered primary is this culture. And is this culture's exploitation? And now, at long last, your question of hope. Yeah, I think one of the things that we need to do first, there's false hope that I think needs to be eradicated. And false hopes bind us to unlivable situations. That's one of the reasons that the thing I was mentioning earlier about at every step of the way, it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist. They had the false hope that if they just go along, they won't get killed. And, my mother, one of the reasons she stayed with my father is because of the false hope that he would change.
Mm-hmm.
And what are the false hopes that bind us to the system? I mean, does anybody really think that Mac Lowe is going to, stop deforesting because we asked nicely? Does anybody think that Monsanto is going to stop Monsantoing because we asked nicely?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we just get a Democrat in the White House, things will be okay. You know, it's like, what are the false hopes that bind us to the system? And that's one start. And another start is that, or another part of this is that, it's not just people say we have to have hope, but I was bashing hope at a talk I did several years ago, and somebody out in the audience interrupted me to shout out, what is your definition of hope? And I didn't have one, so I asked them to define it. And the definition they came up with is, hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency.
Mm.
But I'm not interested in hope. What I'm interested in is agency.
Right.
I'm interested in in us finding what we love and figuring out what it will take to defend our beloved and then doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I think in addition to talking about resistance, I think there's also another way to look at this, which is community enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
What would happen if we in our community decide that we are going to have a cancer-free zone,
mm-hmm.
and that we will do, and we're going to have a police force that enforces this and that shuts down every, chemical refinery.
Right.
And this is what we are going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And of course this would go against the government. It ends up being the same thing. It's resistance.
Yes.
But it's just another way to look at resistance. It's a way to reframe that discussion.
Right. And
which leads to the same thing, of course, of resistance against exploitation.
Right. And I see direct action as taking back that agency, that the end result mm-hmm. of civilization and social order has been that we are disempowered, we have no agency to act, or we're convinced that we don't. And when people
yep.
commit direct action, they're taking that back.
This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, and you're listening to Radio EcoShock.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that's a huge, huge, huge thing, which is one of the reasons I think that so many of the Indians would fight back much more, is that I was just reading a quote by one Indian today, who's a Lakota man, I believe, who was saying that everything about our culture is aimed toward making us realize that it's our responsibility to figure out, it's our responsibility, that what we need to do is to take responsibility for our own lives.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's really crucial is that agency. And it's one of the things, of course, that's just entirely undercut. You know, we give up decision making to judges and attorneys. We give up communal protection to the police. We give up big scale decision making to politicians. At every level, every step of the way, we cede responsibility
mm-hmm.
until I get a choice of working for, you know, IBM or Microsoft.
Not much of a choice.
No.
Coke
no.
or Pepsi.
Yeah. Well, you certainly can't drink the water in the river anymore, can you?
Mm-mm. Derek Jensen, you're speaking in Vancouver on April 18th, and the title of your talk is Taking Action in a Culture of Violence. Now, tell us what we can expect from that.
Well, what I'll talk about primarily is the question, do you believe that the culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? I ask that question to people all over the country, and nobody ever says yes. And if you don't believe the culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living, what does that mean for our strategy and for our tactics? And the answer is we don't know. And the reason we don't know is because we don't talk about it. And the reason we don't talk about it is because we're all so busy pretending that we have hope. But, you know, I was doing a talk a few years ago, and it's actually a huge audience. We're all excited. Yeah, let's bring down civilization. Rah, rah. It's like a rock concert, you know? And then at one point I just stopped and I said, okay, how many people in this room, in this theater actually, have ever filed a timber sale appeal? And it was me and one other person raised our hand. Mm-hmm. I said, okay, how many people have ever done any work like at a battered women's shelter? Maybe a half dozen women raised their hand. How many people have ever worked on a rape crisis hotline? 4 or 5 people. How many people have ever done any indigenous solidarity work? 3 or 4 people. And, you know, questions like that. And my point is that resistance and what I think is necessary runs the entire gamut. And I think we need all forms of resistance. We need many forms of resistance, let me put it that way. But there's so much work. I mean, that we need so much resistance, some of which is not sanctioned by the, you know, corporatocracy that runs everything. But at the same time, there is so much work that is absolutely positively legal and above ground that people simply aren't doing.
Mm-hmm.
A great example of that is that, you know, there's this, developer, I hate calling him that, you know, because beautiful forests don't develop into subdivisions.
Mm-hmm.
So this destroyer, you know, this guy wants to make a bunch of money. This outsider is what he is. He's not even part of this neighborhood. He's trying to build a subdivision on 20 acres right near here. And we in the neighborhood have fought him for the last almost 2 years now. It's like 20 months. And, you know, nothing illegal has been done. You know, we haven't, you know, hit him in the head with a war club. We haven't, slashed his tires. We haven't, you know, done anything at all. And what we've done is we've poured through county zoning regulations. Mm-hmm. We found the ways that he's lying. Mm-hmm. We beat him at the Planning Commission. We beat him at the Board of Supervisors. He's now taken it to California Department of Forestry. He said, if you won't let me put in the neighborhood, I'm going to clear cut. And so far, we're stopping him at CDF. And mm-hmm. and if we don't stop at CDF, we're going to sue him. We're not going to. And my point is that's all legal, and
right.
a lot of it is really tedious,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of it is just, the game is, of course, rigged in their favor,
mm-hmm.
but, and frankly, the reason that we've been able to win with this guy so far is because he's so arrogant, and he's so used to just walking over people, even in this pretty right-wing community, we're able to stop him so far.
They call it the paper monkey wrench.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have any new books in the works?
Oh my gosh. Okay, so Endgame came out about a year ago. Mm-hmm. I've got another book coming out in a month or so, which is an anti-zoo book.
Mm-hmm.
It's written with Karen Tweedy Holmes, the photographer, and it's coming out through No Voice Unheard. It's about a 150-page essay along with her amazing photographs. And then I have a book coming out next January from Seven Stories, called As the World Burns, 50 Things You Can Do to Stay in Denial. It's a graphic novel done with Stephanie McMillan, who does the wonderful cartoon Minimum Security.
Mm-hmm.
And that book really started off as sort of poking fun at all those stupid 50 Simple Things You Can Do to Save the Planet books that are just ridiculous, and this idea that if we just, there's this line by Zygmunt Bauman where he says, rational people go quietly, meekly into the gas chamber if only you allow them to believe it's a bathroom. And I've changed that to be, rational people go quietly, meekly into the end of the world if only you allow them to believe that compact fluorescence will save the day. And so this book starts off there, and then ends up these aliens, these big space aliens, invade the planet, alien machines invade the planet, and they're going to consume every living thing. And one of their waste products is gold, and so they give the president a bunch of gold to give them permits to eat everything on the planet. And since they have permits, it's all legal, so nobody can stop them. So, the big green environmental organizations are like, maybe we can stop them on procedural grounds. And finally, they make mm-hmm. a deal that the president will take the permits back from the aliens and give them back to the corporations, because of course the corporations are supposed to consume the planet, not aliens.
Right.
And in exchange for leaving behind 50 trees, 50 bushes, 50 rocks, 50 fish, those the environmentalists get. And the big green environmentalists are really happy with that deal. And then finally what happens, and I'm sort of going to ruin the end of the book. No, I'm not going to ruin the end of the book. People have to buy it. I'll tell you this much.
Okay.
But what happens is the wild animals start fighting back then against the machines, and then there's not enough of them. They need help, so they send off the wind and the insects and the birds to fly out to ask help from the domesticates. And that includes the pets, and it includes, domesticated cows, some of them break out of field, and includes the domesticated humans. There's one scene I'm really pleased with near the end where there's a woman standing over a stove, and this plant in the windowsill says to her, you're as pot-bound as I am. Let's go fight back. And when the fighting's done, you can plant me in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, why not? She walks out of the house with her big, big knife to go fight the machine. So there's that book, and then I wrote a couple other books a couple years ago that my agent has not been able to find a publisher for. I'll probably publish them myself. And right now I'm writing a book about I can't say on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
I'm writing a book about feces.
Mm-hmm.
And how this culture has taken something that used to be a tremendous gift to the land base and turned into something poisonous. And how in a sustainable culture, including a non-human sustainable culture, all of your products are helpful to the land. There is no such thing as waste. That if I defecate, somebody else, slugs or flies or the soil itself, eats it.
Mm-hmm.
And this culture produces wastes that are not useful but instead harmful. And how that's one more way to get at sustainability.
That's a lot of work that's going to be coming in the future.
Yeah.
Mm.
You know, I've I'm actually thinking that I'm really tired, and not just because I'm touring so much. I think I might take a couple months off this summer because, well, one, I've been really sick for the last couple years, and then also, I've written, I think, 13 books or something in the last 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I was thinking, you know, when I finish Endgame, I'm going to take a break. And I finished it in November of whatever year that was. And then by the end of December, I'd written that anti-zoo book. And then in the next year, I wrote those two novels. And then, you know, it just goes on. I haven't taken a break in years. And I go back and forth because, you know, things are so, so desperate. And I can't stop, you know, and for a couple reasons I can't stop. One is because things are so desperate and they're getting worse every day. And another reason is because I'm so in love, you know, I'm in love with, and that's what you do. If you love someone and they're being hurt or being killed, you do what you can. You don't rest. And then also, I'm very aware of my own mortality. I mean, I don't want to die with 8 books still in me, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't want to die and, you know, look back at the very last second and say, I wish I could have done more. I wish I could have done this much more to help the salmon. I wish I could have done, you know, this much more to help the redwood trees.
Right.
I want to die. When I die, I want to be spent.
Right.
And I want it to be like, you know how there's some days where you work really, really hard and then you go to sleep and you're so, so, so ready to go to sleep?
Mm-hmm.
That's how I want to die. Is like when, you know, it's like, you know what? I'm done. There's nothing else I can do.
Derek Denton, you'll be at Langara College on April 18th talking about taking action in a culture of violence. And thank you very much.
On the 19th.
You're going to be in Gibson's on April the 19th. And then also on the weekend, you're doing a special sustainability conference on Bowen Island. And all that information is on your website at www.derekjensen.org. Mm-hmm. And I want to thank you very much for taking all the time with us today.
Well, thank you. Your question's great.
All right. We'll talk to you again soon, I hope.
Thanks. I hope so, too.
That was author Derek Jensen. And I'm Zoe Blunt for Wild Earth Radio. Thanks for listening.
Our thanks to Zoe Blunt of Wild Earth Radio for that interview with Derek Jensen. If you missed part of it, you can download the whole thing from this website, www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, all.net. This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, and you're listening to Radio EcoShock. Next, we explore one of BC's unknown ocean treasures, the glass sponge reefs.
I would like you, if you could, to explain to our listeners who you are and what your purpose for visiting British Columbia is.
Yeah, well, I'm Manfred Grauer. I'm professor for paleobiology in Germany, in Hanover now. And I was working actually here in Canada with the sponge reefs, which you can find on the coast of British Columbia, on the deep water, since 1999. And I'm right now over here to educate people a little bit about the sponge reefs because they are threatened by groundwater trawling, and already 50% of the sponge reefs have gone, so we are in kind of a hurry to get the rest of the sponge reefs preserved actually.
All right, well, let's back up a little bit. I'm sorry to say that many of our listeners will think of sponges and think of their kitchen or bathroom sponge.
Yes.
So what is a sponge and what is a glass sponge?
Mm-hmm. Well, in general, a sponge is a very primitive organism, which is mostly a marine organism living on the floor of the seafloor. And glass sponges are very special sponges, actually, because they have a skeleton which is completely made out of glass, of silica. So that's actually the main difference to all other sponges, you know, you probably know, like the bath sponge. So these glass sponges, they are not squeezable. They are very, very brittle and fragile. And that makes them very, very sensitive organisms.
Huh. Could we see through them?
Well, if they decay, if the soft tissue is gone, you could see through them, yes.
And they're found only in British Columbia, you say?
The reefs are found only in British Columbia. These reefs were known from the Earth history since more than 200 million years, and we paleobiologists, actually, we thought that these reefs have died out 40 million years ago, and so I was pretty amazed when Canadian scientists found them again, actually, as like living dinosaurs, found them again on the seafloor here on the BC shelf. The sponges itself, the glass sponges itself, are known from the northern hemisphere, from all oceans, but they are very randomly. You know, if you would have collect one, that would be quite a hard task to do that. But here on the BC shelf, they are in incredible amounts, building these reef structures up to 24 meters high, which is let's say an eight-story building. And they cover an area altogether of about 1,000 square kilometers. We have four large sponge reef areas or sponge reef sites in Hecate Strait and Queen Charlotte Sound, and the northern one in Hecate Strait covers an area of 425 square kilometers, which is more or less twice the size as Saanich Insula, for example.
That is amazing. And so the trawlers come along and just scrape the bottom with heavy equipment, and I guess they damage or destroy these reefs?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, at the moment there is kind of a trawling closure, which has to be renewed yearly. But as I said before, 50% of the sponge reefs have already gone by trawling, so we are in a hurry to protect the rest of it, you know, because they are globally unique. You don't find these reefs nowhere else on Earth. They are just here on the coast of BC.
And I suppose because they're on the ocean bottom, it would be up to the federal government to make some sort of protection law for them.
Yeah, well, what we want to see is that these reef sites were protected as an MPA under the Ocean Act.
Marine protected area.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You'd almost think they'd be a UN heritage site or something. I mean, if 200 million years and this is the only one left.
Yeah, right. We did that actually in 2004. We put them on the list for future UNESCO World Nature Heritage, but it couldn't be done because the reef sites had no permanent protection. So that's the very first step. We have to get them under permanent protection and not under, let's say, under a yearly protection, which has to be renewed yearly. Excuse me.
So Canada has to act first, really.
Yeah.
And have you been in touch with the people in the Canadian government to try and get this done?
Oh, yeah. I was over here last November, and we were in Ottawa for 1 week. We spoke to members of parliament. We spoke to senators. We spoke to deputy ministers. We spoke to very, very much different people in different organizations. And now I'm here, and, I was this last week and this week I was speaking to a whole bunch of different, local important people here in BC. So we try to push, you know, things forward from very different directions.
Is there a website where we can actually see these reefs?
Yeah, I have a website over in Germany where I put together lots of information about the sponge reefs, even fossilized sponge reefs. So I have some, you know, video types from this made from the submersible dives we did, and lots of slides or pictures are on my website. Well, the website is www.porifera.org.
And how do we spell porifera?
P-O-R-I-F-E-R-A.
.org.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, porifera.org. Well, I'm going to go and have a look at that, because you're telling me about something I really just didn't know about, and I'm sure many of my listeners wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
Now, once we realize the wonders that are there, what should we be doing to support saving them?
Well, you could write to your MP or MLA, you know, to support the sponge reefs, to protect the sponge reefs. That would help a lot if lots of people of BC would write the letters, or even to the minister to Loyola Hearn, That would help a lot, actually.
Okay, and is there a lot more research left to be done on this?
Oh, yeah, you know, these glass sponges, I think they are among the most enigmatic animals we have on Earth. We have actually no idea how they reproduce. We have a vague idea how fast they grow. We don't exactly what they need of what kind of food they need. We don't know how they can live in those depths actually. So it's a small group worldwide who are who are doing science with these sponges. Though there's for the next decades there's a lot of things to do.
Well, we've been speaking with Dr. Crowder from Germany about the glass sponge reefs, and we were referred by the Canadian Parks and Wilderness Society. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Oh, you're very much welcome.
We just have time left for this speech given at the Water Day event here in Vancouver in March and recorded by Ann Jamieson of Investing in Health, another fine CFRO program heard every Tuesday at 1 o'clock. We're about to find out the myths we all believe about Canada's pristine and inexhaustible water supply just aren't true.
Karen Backer is an associate professor of the Department of Geography and director of the Program on Water Governance at the University of BC, Institute for Resources, Environment, and Sustainability.
But what I hope to do tonight is walk you through some of the main arguments that have been made by the 27 contributors to this book, O Canada, recently edited and produced by UBC Press. This book emerged from a conversation, an extended conversation between academics and activists, government scientists, researchers, environmental lawyers, campaigners all across the country. And there are many messages in the book, but what I want to focus on tonight is the way in which those contributors debunk several core myths that Canadians have about their water. And those myths are important because they structure a lot of our thinking about our water, and they structure a lot of our activism around our water. So I'll walk you through those myths and hope to debunk some myths that at least some of you hold dear. One of the central myths that a lot of the authors in this collection addressed was this notion that Canada is the Kuwait of the world's fresh water, that we have disproportionately abundant fresh water supplies, that our waters are pristine, and that they're protected by vast expanses of wilderness, and that this differentiates us from our thirsty, wasteful, rapacious neighbor to the south. Let's look at that first myth, that Canada has a disproportionately abundant share of the world's fresh water. And this is a myth that's shared by lots of people in senior positions in government, not just the media. So former environment minister at the federal level David Anderson, or then ambassador to the U.S. Raymond Chrétien, are on record in the media and in public as making statements along the lines of Canada has 20% of the world's fresh water. Simply not true. If you look at the statistics, it's not a trivial matter to come up with these statistics, but Canada has about 7%, just under 7% of the world's annual renewable fresh water. And that's not a disproportionate share in terms of our land mass. And in fact, it's just about the same share as the United States. In addition, a lot of the water that we have flows north and is far removed from centers of population. A lot of the water we see on our landscape, stored water, makes us think we're extremely water abundant. It's in part due to our topography and climate. We've got a glaciated topography with lots of holes. We've got some rain and low evapotranspiration, so those holes fill up with water. Those are lakes. And those lakes, it is true, hold a lot of water, probably between 15 and 20% of the world's fresh water. But the rate at which those lakes renew, like the Great Lakes, is only about, on average, 1 or 2% per year. And property owners, beachfront, waterfront owners on the Great Lakes have discovered this to their chagrin in the past few years because lower levels in the Great Lakes, due to pretty small changes in rainfall, actually, have led to many of them being mudfront owners rather than beachfront owners, several hundred meters in some instances from the edge of the water. Myth number two, Canada's water is well protected. Murray referred to this. We're one of the only industrialized countries in the world that has guidelines for drinking water, not laws. Anything you ingest in terms of food in Canada is much better regulated than anything, any water you ingest, either bottled water or tap water. Moreover, those drinking water guidelines don't have to be applied in all jurisdictions. They're merely suggestions made at the federal level, and in fact, they're not applied in all jurisdictions across Canada and don't even apply at all on First Nations reserves. And it turns out that even so, many of our water quality standards for drinking water are lower than countries like the U.S., European Union, or Australia, and lower than most of the standards for those jurisdictions. David Boyd, through the Suzuki Foundation, has done some really interesting comparative work and come up with some pretty startling statistics. For example, we rank fairly low amongst OECD countries, the wealthiest countries in the world, for things like sewage treatment. And that ranking kind of disguises the fact that on a per capita wealth basis, Canada still engages in some practices that most other countries with our levels of wealth have dispensed with. For example, disposing of raw sewage into ocean environments. And we've got, a local example. We've got a local example here in Victoria and also at the other end of the country in Halifax with raw sewage still being dispensed into ocean environments, something that the European Union, for example, has banned entirely. We also have very lax standards dealing with water resources in the environment. And here I'll give the example of Alberta's oil sands. Most of you are probably familiar with the oil sands case, second largest oil reserves in the world after Saudi Arabia. Enormous extraction efforts ramping up, mostly along the Athabasca River. Here's some satellite photos of the Suncor and Syncrude operations. And those big areas of water you can see aren't lakes, they're tailings ponds. The reason they're there is because the tar sands are bituminous. And what that basically means is that the oil is in the form of a kind of tarry, sticky goo, mixed up with sand, and to extract the oil, water is used as steam in large quantities, about 2 to 4 barrels of oil, water per barrel of oil are needed to extract usable oil from the tar sands, and more water is then used to upgrade that oil. And that means that there's an enormous amount of toxic water which can't be returned to the environment, which is sequestered in tailings ponds. There are no regulations in place to deal with that water. In fact, there aren't even regulations in place to deal with how much water can be abstracted from the Athabasca River, which has really important implications for the Peace Athabasca Delta downstream of Ramsar Convention site, and really important trapping and hunting grounds for First Nations. So the Alberta oil sands is a great example of the way in which water policy for resource extraction in Canada has really sacrificed hydrological integrity and created environmental legacies in the kind of Orwellian language of bureaucrats that we haven't really come to terms with collectively. Interestingly, by the way, these regulations in Alberta are a lot more lax than they would be in American states like Texas. The third myth, Canadians use water wisely. Well, we use about 350 liters of water per person per day. That's more than any country in the world except the U.S. But water use started declining in the U.S. about 20 years ago. They've effectively decoupled the link between economic growth and increasing water use. So they have in Britain, they have in lots of countries. We haven't done so in Canada. Overall, although there's some exceptions, like cities in the Okanagan that have really come to grips with demand management, overall, water use per capita is continuing to increase in Canada. That's true in urban as well as rural areas. So here's a map of Alberta, and you'll see slowly coming up dots on the map, and those represent water wells drilled in Alberta per decade from the turn of the century. And what's astounding about this picture is the extent of coverage and the density of coverage, and these wells are for oil and gas extraction. This is pre-oil sands. This is for conventional oil extraction for which smaller amounts of water are needed, as well as agricultural and residential uses. And you can copy that sort of image largely across the country. Far more intensive use in rural areas than we typically think of. Myth number four, our waters in wilderness areas are still relatively pristine. But as the previous map hinted at, human activity in many parts of Canada compromises water quality and hydrological integrity in watersheds. Here's a map that was put together by a landscape ecologist, Brad Stelfox, in the southern foothills area of Alberta. And when you start adding in cultivated land, settlements, roads, railroads, feedlots, wind turbines, oil and gas wells, pipelines, water wells, power lines, and cut lines, what you see is what is supposed to be one of southern Alberta's protected, semi-protected areas, is one that suffers from a lack of what ecologists would call integrity in the landscape, because so many human interventions in the landscape have basically cut up, sliced up the landscape with important implications for in lots of ways, not just hydrological integrity. An example a bit closer to home is that of resource roads in BC. Not a lot of people realize, I didn't realize till recently, that there are more than twice as many resource roads, that is things like logging roads, in BC as there are paved roads, provincially federally administered roads. We've got about 200,000 kilometers of paved roads in BC, or public roads, and about 500,000 kilometers of resource roads. In fact, we don't even keep good track of where all those resource roads are. There's almost no coordination between sectors. There's, I would say, variable and in some cases not great standards about the construction and maintenance of those roads, and there's hardly any surveillance of deactivated roads, all of which can have pretty important impacts on local hydrology. Myth number five, we manage water better than our rapacious neighbor to the south. Well, you could argue this a bunch of ways, but I did want to point out two important facts. We are the largest diverter of water in the world by several orders of magnitude, certainly much more than the U.S. Most of those diversions have been for hydroelectricity. We've diverted water across water basin boundaries in most instances, and these are the sorts of diversions that ecologists worry about, because when you move water from one basin to another, you can have all sorts of ecological impacts you don't anticipate. And moreover, the U.S. definitely has stronger legal water protection and better water data than we do. They've got the Clean Water Act. We've got nothing that's equivalent. And to give you a specific example, Canada hasn't even finished mapping its groundwater resources. We simply don't know where they all are. But in the U.S., you can go online through the EPA and also state departments of the environment and access real-time groundwater data in terms of groundwater levels and recharge. I mean, the amount of data that's publicly available in the U.S. is astounding. If there is data in Canada, it's often something you have to purchase from the government if they even know they have it. So can we really be the world's Kuwait of water? I've obviously argued that we're not and we shouldn't be, but that the assumption that we can be can lead us down really dangerous paths. Like the assumption we have an enormous amount of pristine water obviously lends support to repeated and recent calls for bulk water exports. But my argument here is that the immediate threat to our water is not the U.S., it is us. And I don't think the immediate threat to our water is the U.S. or bulk water exports, because water use has been declining in the U.S., because new water-saving and water-efficient technologies are coming online, like everything from drip irrigation to desalination, and because a lot of these projects in cost-benefit terms or even political terms are too costly for people to support. However, fear of our neighbor to the south does distract us from the real issues at hand here in Canada, and here I've listed some of them, and there's a whole range explored in the book and by people across Canada, but I just wanted to point out a few. And the first is water supply in rural communities and on First Nations reserves. Many of you might know that anywhere between a quarter to a third of First Nations reserves are regularly under boil water advisories in Canada. They suffer from very poor water quality standards. Keshechewan was just one example. But you can generalize that to lots of rural communities in Canada who don't have support and who are not backed up by legally enforceable drinking water standards. A second issue is water quality, particularly microbiological water quality, but also things like new pollutants related to pharmaceuticals, biomagnification of ordinary products like the chemicals that are in sunscreen. The issue here, I think, that's particularly worrying is that our federal government and our provincial governments haven't gotten to grips with these new pollutants. It can take up to 10 years for the laborious bureaucratic process at the federal level to examine and decide upon a standard for a new pollutant to be entered into the Canadian Drinking Water Guidelines, and then it's by no means certain that those will actually be applied in every province. That's far too slow. A third issue that's of great concern is climate change. So here we have an issue that is coming to increasing attention, particularly in the prairies, partly because of the partitioning of rainfall between summer and winter months. So we might have less rainfall in the summer, more rainfall in the winter, but also because of the drying up of the Rocky Mountain glaciers, upon which all of these boom towns in the prairies, like Fort McMurray, but also established cities like Calgary and huge agricultural areas, depend. Boundary waters, a fourth important issue. Those of you who follow the debates over the Great Lakes recently will have seen recalcitrant, timid, and lax stance of the federal government, whose constitutional responsibility is to safeguard boundary waters. It's been in retreat for the past 30 years from its water-related responsibilities. It got so bad in the mid-1990s that they had to establish a Where's Water team in the federal government to even figure out whether they were meeting all their water-related responsibilities. And the Commissioner for the Environment and Sustainable Development and the Senate Committee have recently come out saying things like the federal government's role in water policy is adrift, shocking, unacceptable. Pretty strong language. Unusually strong language. The fifth issue that we'll get into a bit with Gwen Barley's presentation is that of commercialization and privatization, something I know that the Council of Canadians has been doing a lot of work on. So here I'll just say, because I know that Gwen will talk about it more, that this applies both to water supply and water resources and is often touted as a sort of win-win solution for both our water problems and our environmental issues, although, as Gwen will suggest, it's a more complicated scenario than that. What are some of the best strategies? These are the things I hope we'll talk about in the discussion period, because lots of groups in Canada are coming up with different strategies to deal with water, and not all of them are heading down the same track. A human right to water has been something the Council of Canadians, as many of you will know, has been campaigning on. Water managers, conventional water managers, have been pushing for things like enforceable laws on water quality. Economists and a lot of water policymakers in both provincial and federal governments are preferring to take a different route, suggesting that, for example, full-cost water pricing or water conservation and efficiency measures, often voluntary or incentive-based, are the way to go. A different set of initiatives comes from urban development initiatives like Smart Growth on the Ground here in BC that seek to focus on the land use and water use link. And other groups, like the Sierra Club, but also the Council of Canadians, are actually saying, no, we need to take this to the federal level. What we need is to push and push strongly for a national water policy, for the federal government to step up to the plate. So what I hope we can get to in the discussion period is a discussion of which of those strategies we should be pursuing and how and where you think this debate should go. And as a final point, I'll just throw up three more websites for the book. For Water Bucket, which is a great information resource for those of you who want more information about water in Canada. And finally, Water Keepers, and I'll just mention them because all the royalties from the book, Go Canada, are going to the Canadian Water Keepers Alliance. They're an organization that selects local water bodies, picks a guardian, a stream keeper, or a bay keeper, and actually seeks to prosecute both private sector companies and governments that fail to respect water legislation such as it is in this country, and they're a great organization. So if you're interested in pursuing the matter further, go check them out too. I'll stop here and go in.
That was UBC Professor Karen Bakker speaking at Vancouver's Water Day event here in Vancouver. You have been listening to the Wednesday preview edition of Radio EcoShock on CFRO Co-op Radio, 102.7 FM in Vancouver. Tune in this Friday for an update on the world climate picture from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, followed by a replay of the provocative interview with Kick It All Over philosopher and activist Derek Jensen. That's Friday at 1 o'clock. And don't miss our Emergency on Planet Earth All-Day Marathon next Tuesday, the 17th,
8 Hours of Fear in Gaia, starting at 12 noon. I'm your host, Alex Smith. You can write to me at radio@ecoshock.org. And we'll be talking soon.
All the protesters are standing up along the line, standing up for what you believe, and it doesn't matter what the price. This is for all the peace lovers who are peacing out on this great land, peacefully being passive, while the